of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 7 p.m. on Monday, April 2nd, 2018. Before we begin, I want to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Maxim, the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to again remind committee members to please silence your cell phones. Present this evening, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Kopp, Representative Stutes, Representative Christ Tompkins, my vice chair, and myself, Representative Clayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business this evening is House Bill 355, Fire, Forest, Land, Crimes, Fire Prevention, sponsored by Representative Guttenberg. This is the fourth hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. To provide a brief recap, earlier today we took up amendments to House Bill 355. So far, the committee has considered amendments 1 through 4. Amendment 1 has been adopted, and amendments 2, 3, and 4 have failed. At this time, we will resume discussion of the remaining amendments to House Bill 355. I'll again put on record that the legislative legal has permission to make any technical and conforming changes to the bill. And when we last recessed, or when we adjourned, we had a motion to adopt Amendment Number 5. And I believe Representative Christ Tompkins, had you objected to Amendment 5, or had we not gotten that far?
No, I don't believe it had been moved.
What's that? Okay. Representative Eastman, would you like to make a motion for Amendment Number 5?
Move Amendment Number 5.
I will object.
Representative Eastman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, bottom of page 3. We have the section, uncontrolled spread of fire, leaving fire unattended. But then when you peel back that subsection, top of page 4, it begins to talk about a person who knows of a fire shall exercise due care to prevent the uncontrolled spread of the fire. And it's separating that from someone who actually sets a fire. And I think in the case where you have someone who's actually setting a fire or participating in setting a fire, it's very appropriate that they should exercise all due care to prevent the uncontrolled spread of the fire. But to then extend that to someone who simply knows of a fire, I mean, if you get an alert on your iPhone that somewhere on your property, which could be on the other side of the state, that there's a fire there, and it's not talking about a wildfire or an out-of-control fire or a bad fire, just a fire of any kind, which one would hope was set by someone else, or lightning or whatnot. How can we legally require that person to exercise care to prevent the uncontrolled spread of the fire? I think that's asking more than the law could or should. If you're setting a fire, you own it, you get to be responsible for that. But if someone else is setting the fire, that person is owning and be responsible for making sure that that fire does not spread uncontrolled.
Questions as to Amendment Number 5?
Question.
Representative Cobb.
Representative Eastman, so in your example, if you know of a fire, as you said, on land owned by you, let's say it's across the state, so it's a few hundred miles from your place. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'll speak into the microphone here. In your scenario where you become aware of a fire on land that you own that's a long ways from you, the way I read this now is that your knowledge of that fire requires a couple things. One, that you have to be in control of the land. So my first question is, are you really in control of the land if you're not directly there in person? And second, the term of the words due care. If you were to notify someone that you are not present to observe it, but you have become aware, in your mind, do you think due care would be carried out if you were to notify the authorities in charge of fire control over the area or any other emergency authority? I'm just trying to
I think the question's pretty clear.
Get at what you're... What
Representative Eastman?
Yeah.
So you actually are not quite catching the meaning of the language before. So on line one, it's land owned, possessed, or controlled. And I think you were just reading or into an and there, meaning that if it was controlled by you, then you should be doing certain things. But what it's saying is, if it's just owned by you, controlled by someone else or whatnot, that the language here before us is that you still have every bit the responsibility of someone who either possesses or controls that. But I think and would be probably a preferable reading. I think there's a natural logic and flow that goes from that. Again, the owned, possessed, or controlled is very expansive. And if we are talking about someone
Representative
else.
Representative Eastman, for purposes of this amendment, there's no amendment to changing owned, possessed, or controlled to owned, possessed, and controlled. The simple question is whether to make this amendment given the language that says owned, possessed, or controlled. Go ahead.
And if we're talking about exercising due care for someone who is setting a fire, I think that makes perfect sense. But your question is more about, what's the due care for someone who simply knows about a fire and it's, therefore not under their control. And we're talking about a fire. We're not talking about a forest fire or a wildfire. Now, if it was a forest fire, a wildfire, then I would hope, you call 911 or whatever to make sure that appropriate resources are put to bear. But we're just talking about someone who knows of a fire. Could be any fire. So you know of a heating fire, and you might not have anything to do with it other than the fact that you heard about it or whatnot. What is the due care at that point? I don't think calling 911 would necessarily be appropriate.
So just a
follow-up? Or it doesn't have to be a question. It can just be a comment.
Sure, just a comment, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chairman, I think the term of use, due care there, alleviates the concern of the maker of this amendment. Due care is a term used to describe both the basic speed rule. The basic speed rule says that at any time you're driving faster than conditions, whether that be weather or what is in the road, could be snow or sleet or fog, limiting your visibility, you should not drive faster than conditions permit. So you can be under the speed limit but still be in violation of the basic rule because you're not exercising due care. Due care is also the term the law uses when it comes to citing people for being responsible in some way for creating a dangerous circumstance, such as drivers to exercise due care to avoid a collision. Because the term due care is here, listening to what the amendment maker has said, if someone was to be aware of a heating fire on property that they either own or possess or control, I would say the fact that it is your understanding that it is a heating fire, that you are not exposing yourself to your liability would expose would be if you felt that heating fire was somehow not attended or had a possibility of becoming dangerously expansive quickly. So the way the language is, I think that the concern is met by the way it's read in context. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to put the amendment in context, and this is existing law, and I guess I have a question for Mr. Meesh to start things off, if I may.
Absolutely, go ahead.
And I realize this doesn't relate directly to Amendment Number 5 from Representative Eastman, but looking at 4115.110 rather, it HB 355 removes all the if such and such person does this, they're guilty of a misdemeanor language. So I'm curious what Section 4115.110 does in that case, and I realize I'm probably missing something that's all tied together in a way that I'm not immediately grasping, but I was hoping if Mr. Mache could speak to
Mr.
that.
Mr. Mache.
Yes, thank you. Hi, this is Chris Mache, Director of the Division of Forestry, and could you please restate your question? You're asking about the current Section 4115.110, the uncontrolled spread of fire or leaving a fire unattended.
That's right, Mr. Mache, through the chair, 4115.110, both A and B lay out if you do this or you do that, you're guilty of a misdemeanor. HB 355 eliminates the "you're guilty of a misdemeanor" language and seems to just sort of create definitions. I'm trying to understand what this section, 4115.110, does if HB 355 passes.
Yes, through the chair, Representative. Those sections about what type of penalty are addressed later in this new version of the bill. It's updating all the statutes to hopefully establish a bail schedule as well as misdemeanor and felony offenses, and so those are brought into this new bill later. So that's why it's struck at this point in the wording.
Okay, thank you. That puts it all in context of follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Christ-Thompson, go ahead.
So given that the language that Representative Eastman is homing in on and the scenario he describes relating to the language that his amendment relates to, have you encountered a scenario where your colleagues, where this has been an issue, where someone knows of a fire but maybe isn't sort of reasonably responsible by any common sense definition, but the person then becomes criminally liable for that fire?
Through the chair to the representative, no, I am not aware of any.
Thank you.
As you described.
Any other questions or comments with regard to amendment number one, or number five, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I didn't see a representative. I looked over there and you didn't have your hand up. Representative Ledoux.
Well, actually, when I first looked at this amendment, I thought it might be talking about, you know, some sort of liability that was on a person who had no connection with the property, who just knew about something and failed to report it. And in our criminal law, we generally don't, unless somebody has a duty to someone or something, we generally don't make them liable for if they're just not responsible, and they don't care to report it to the police or the fire department or something like that. There's no liability there. But then when I looked at this and saw that it only related to people who owned, possessed, or controlled by the person, it kind of makes sense to me that those people would have a duty to use common sense. So I won't support this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. I don't see any other comments. Representative Eastman, you've got 1 minute for wrap-up.
Yes, I think we would like to read into this the fact that we're not just dealing with the existence of a fire, but that we're actually talking about some kind of dangerous fire or likely to be dangerous fire or uncontrolled fire. And I think if we're talking about an uncontrolled fire, then you should have a duty of care to, you know, deal with that if it's on your property and you know about it. But because we're just talking about the fact that it is a plain old fire, and you, by implication, did not start it or have any part in starting it, I'm not supportive of attaching criminal liability in that situation.
Thank you very much. Is the objection maintained?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Please call the roll.
Representative Christ-Tompkins?
No.
Nay. Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Nay. Representative Rumbold is absent. Representative Kopp?
No.
Nay. Representative Stutes?
No.
Nay. Representative Ledoux?
No.
Nay. Jay Clement? Chair
No.
No. One yay, five yays.
So by a vote of 1-5, amendment number 5 has failed. That brings us to amendment number 6, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So you'll find in section 13.
Representative Eastman, you need to move the amendment.
Yes. I move amendment number 6.
I will object.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. On page 4, section 13 is where we're at. And so this deals with failure to assist in preventing or suppressing fires. Now, currently, it reads, if an officer or employee of the United States or the state who is authorized to prevent or suppress fires requests a person to assist in the prevention or suppression of a fire and informs the person of the officer or employee's official status, and the person fails to assist the officer or employee in the performance of duties, the person is guilty of a misdemeanor. And what it's being changed to here, and the only portion this amendment is going to deal with, is not dealing with someone who is authorized to prevent or suppress fires, but someone who is not authorized to prevent or suppress fires, but is authorized to investigate said fires, requests help, then we're now attaching criminal liability to someone for not helping someone who whose duties do not involve the prevention or the suppressing of fires. I think that there's some logical problems with that. If they are authorized to prevent, suppress forest or other fires, and they ask for help, the law currently reads. But if they are not authorized to prevent, suppress fires, I don't think we should be adding them to the list of people who can now have the authority to order you to do something, and then you'd be criminally liable if you don't do it. That'd be one thing if someone was, if this was just part of those duties previously, and I've had some of those duties myself in the fire service. If we're talking about someone who can prevent, investigate, and suppress fires, I think that makes perfect sense. But for someone who can't prevent and suppress fires, that's not part of their duties. Ordering someone else to help them prevent and suppress fires, I think that's a little bit of a leap.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Representative Ledoux, questions or comments? Both are welcome.
Yeah. Yep. And the gentleman on the phone is Mr. Mache?
Right, he's the state forester.
Okay. So, under the current...
Mr. Mache, you better listen up.
I'm listening. Thank you.
So, under the current law, can you request somebody to help you who has nothing to do with the starting of the fire?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes, one of our fire staff could make a request of someone to help, such as perhaps call 911 to report the fire while the fire prevention officer undertakes suppression action. All of our officers do have the authority to suppress and control in addition to investigate.
Follow-up?
So is that normal in... And I guess this question is going to be to Representative Kopp. When you were a law enforcement officer, could you request somebody to help you with something? And if they didn't help you, let's assume this is just a bystander. And they were around and you said, hey, go do something. And they said, no, I don't think I want to do something. Can you arrest somebody for not doing what a law enforcement officer tells you to do, even if they have nothing to do with the crime? Because I didn't think that's how our laws worked, actually.
So, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes. So it's called failure to respond to requests for assistance at the direction of a uniformed police officer. And it is actually a misdemeanor offense to fail. Now, to fail to respond to that request. Now, it's been a while since I've read that section of law, but that's been on in the books for many decades. And it is in response to the immediacy of need for help, where emphasizing that law enforcement is a collective societal responsibility, and there are times when you literally need all hands on deck to safely bring a situation to a safe resolution. Now, I personally never use that, but it is this is consistent with the law on the Title 11 criminal side that has been there for many decades. We could look it up really quick if we wanted to, Mr. Chairman. But the thing I noticed about the word investigate added into here is by including that term, you're definitely talking about deputy fire marshals or fire marshals. You're talking about uniform peace officers who are sworn. And so by having them in there, that indicates it makes it logically consistent than in the statute, consistent with Title 11, that if you have someone there who's investigating where there could be criminal liability to the person who started the fire, that if the urgency of suppressing that fire required immediate assistance, there could be criminal liability attached to the person for failing to supply that assistance. The law has always recognized the defense of, you know, you're physically unable, or there's other things that can cause a person to be immune from prosecution. And I'm personally not aware of that being used, and I've never used it myself, but it has been on the books for decades in Title 11.
So could I have a follow-up with Representative Kopp?
Yeah, but let me just give you an example. This is a real world example in the fire context. Back in 2016, or maybe it was 15, there was a fire on Kodiak Island called the Twin Creeks Fire that started, I'm not sure where it started, but it picked up and it started racing into forested lands that were owned by the Kodiak Island Borough. And there was a timber harvesting operation that was working on the island at the time. And basically when that fire started, the fire folks immediately contacted the harvester saying they needed their assistance, and they stopped all operations to the extent they could put equipment to mobilize in the firefighting. They went to do it because they were actually one of the few people on Kodiak Island that had any kind of equipment resources available to respond, and to the extent that they incurred costs, they went back later and say, well, we need help, this is how much money we spent, but they pretty much stopped everything to fight the fire. But that gets to the follow-up of the representative.
So, and I mean, I understand what you're saying there, and I think most people would respond that way, but yet in tort liability, in civil liability, there's absolutely no obligation to help somebody, and you're never going to be civilly liable for failure to help somebody, even though you could help somebody, you know, with just making a telephone call, and that's something.
So actually, Mr. I wouldn't argue tort liability. That's you guys are all way smarter than me on the all that stuff. But in our criminal law, you know, we've had it for a long time. Thanks to our former Senator Dyson, you know, failure to report a violent crime against an adult or a child. We've had that on the books for, I don't know, going on 18 years now, where just having knowledge and failing to report that a crime had occurred or is ongoing exposes you to misdemeanor penalties. So on the criminal side, we've had that on the books for some time.
Representative Ledoux.
I thought that only was if you had a duty to the person. For example, you were the doctor. I mean, there are certain mandatory reporters. So I guess, but you're shaking your head. So my question is, in the criminal law, would the word investigate be in there?
As I said, I haven't read that statute in a while. I'd have to look at it. But and that's one of the things police officers do is they investigate. And so when I look at the term investigate, to me that elevates this above a normal fire service officer who's there to either suppress or either prevent or suppress the fire. Investigation rapidly gets into the criminal arena. And I would love if the fire chief there would help me out with this. But my guess is that you are insinuating a law enforcement function there, and that is why you're also consistent with the Title 11 directive. I think that's where they're going, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to know if I'm correct on that.
So we do have some attorneys from the Department of Law available. One of the questions that I think has been raised by this conversation, Representative Ledoux, is actually whether adding the term investigate, which is what this amendment seeks to remove, whether whether the officer or employee of the United States or the state, by adding investigate, whether that makes it a narrower class of people that can exercise that authority to give orders, or whether it makes it a broader class of people.
It has an or in it, so it wouldn't narrow it.
You may be right about that, but let's get, I'm thinking, because we're dealing with issues of criminal liability, we should get Aaron Peterson from the Department of Law Criminal Division to. Mr. Peterson, have you been listening to this discussion?
Yes, sir.
Can you provide illumination and perspective? Or else I can ask you a question, but I don't think you need to hear the question.
So, through the chair, what Representative Ledoux just said about the disjunctive operator there is correct, or offsets investigate from suppress or prevent. So it would be adding the class of responders that would be investigating separate from suppress or prevent. They would also, if they only had the authority to prevent fires, for example, they would have the same authority under this statute as someone who only had the authority to suppress or to investigate. But as I think was just put on the record, the FPOs that I think this is directed at, fire protection officers, they have the ability and, in fact, the duty to do all three. So the purpose behind this, I believe, is really to, is because the FPOs rely on public cooperation when they're trying to determine if a fire exists. And a good example might be, you know, if they thought there was smoke in a certain area, but you know, the only entrance that they could drive on, somebody had parked a truck across and said, hey, you need to move that so we can get back there. And that is something that has come up in other fires recently. You know, they would have the duty to move their truck in that circumstance. And that's obviously without a law that created a duty, then they might just say, well, I'm parked here. Go ahead and give me a traffic ticket for not moving, but I'm not going to move it.
Representative Ledoux, follow-up.
So I guess I'm just interested in when it's the police officer, as Representative Kopp was talking about. Would there be in, I guess, Title 11, maybe we could get a copy of this Title 11 thing.
Go ahead.
Any criminal liability if somebody refuses to help somebody in an investigation?
You're talking about fire investigation or any investigation?
Well, any investigation.
So, Mr. Peterson?
So, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, there is a statute, it's 1156.720, and I don't know if that's the one that Representative Kopp is referring to, but that's the one that I pulled up for this hearing. Refusing to assist a peace officer or judicial officer. And that creates the duty to respond appropriately to a request from law enforcement to do something, to make a good faith effort, physically assist the officer if necessary. And it's limited to what an officer is doing in their official capacity, of course. It also, because it came up earlier, has a civil liability bar to civil liability in subsection B there. It also already came up that there is sort of an axiom of criminal law that someone has to do an affirmative act or omit to do something that they're required to do by law before criminal liability can attach. And this statute simply, well, as it has, actually, 4115.120, has for decades created that duty for folks to respond appropriately to requests from prevention, suppression, fire, we'll call them officers for lack of a better term, to respond to their requests appropriately. And this would, of course, add in those that are investigating. Again, as I said, that's because of the specific role that the FPO has, and we've already talked about that in previous hearings. But
Representative Ledoux, follow up.
So how would you see this playing out? What additional authority, when it comes, does the word investigate add to it? Where does it come into play?
Well, to the chair, Representative Ledoux, and I think Mr. Mesh already said that, you know, the FPOs already have the authority to prevent and suppress, so I would have to ask him if there are any folks in forestry that only have the authority to investigate. But in as much as we're talking about folks that only have the authority to investigate, I would say that the hypothetical that I already raised about, you know, if investigators need to check a certain area of land, but it's barricaded off, you know, and that, again, as I said, that's something that's happened before. You know, a barrier is erected because someone doesn't want the fire investigators, I think in that case it was fire prevention, but coming onto their land, but it's necessary in that case to find out if the forest fire is going that way or was started there or, you know, if there's a forest fire at all. Obviously, finding out early and preventing it is the best way to prevent, you know, another Card Street fire or Bunny River fire, Sockeye fire, take your pick. So any situation that you can imagine where someone is preventing a fire investigator from being able to do their job and determine what is going on with the fire would fall under this category.
Representative Ledoux.
Would this also include, though, okay, so you know there's a fire, and you're not really doing anything to figure out whether there's a fire, but you're simply investigating it for purposes of who might have started the fire. And that doesn't seem to me to be something that you'd necessarily need all hands on deck for.
Mr. Right, Peterson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ledoux. Is the question, would this extend to, say, for example, a fire investigator after the fact trying to come onto somebody's land and saying, hey, help me figure out what happened here?
Yeah. Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
I think I would submit that when statutes are read, they have to be read. You know, any word isn't read in isolation. It's a thing is known by those around it, right? It's how the Latin escapes me. It's nos tutoras socis or something of that nature. And I think that if you read this statute, this section in whole, it becomes clear that what it's designed to do, and especially because it's under Title 41, it applies to FPOs, Division of Forestry, fire investigators that are in the, you know, maybe not immediate response, but the early stages of the response to a forest fire or potential forest fire. And the potential forest fire is what we're talking about here. I don't think that under the Constitution the legislature could say, you know, everybody that's contacted by an investigator has to assist them regardless of the stage of that investigation. And I think we've already talked about that a little bit. The Fourth Amendment would have some weight in there. So this is very much in line with the rest of the statute. It's very much talking about FPOs, Division of Forestry, responding to fires in the early stages or potential fires.
An example, and you'll get your follow-up to Representative Ledoux. I think a practical example would be there's a report of smoke coming from a particular area. The source of it is somewhat uncertain. It's no longer preventing, because preventing fires are sort of the fire never starts, but now there's smoke coming from an area. There's concern that a fire might be starting. At this point, they're not really ready to go suppress something because they're not quite sure what the smoke is, but they want to go figure out what's going on, and so they want to figure that out before it does become a forest fire. And so should that employee, that basically that fire investigator, have the authority to ask for get assistance to investigate, to decide what to do? And do we, specifically for purposes of the amendment, do we want to not have people that investigate included amongst the description of people who can make the requests?
And just in following up, actually, I've just read this thing again, and while it adds investigate to the people who are authorized to prevent, investigate, or suppress, it makes it very clear that they need to request a person to assist in the prevention or suppression of a fire, as opposed to assist in the prevention, suppression, or investigation of a fire. So I'm actually happy.
Comfortable with the...
Yeah,
you don't support the amendment?
No, okay. Once I've actually read it.
Okay. Now. Any further comments or questions as to amendment number 6? Hearing and seeing none, Representative Easton, you have a minute in wind-up.
Thank you. So if this amendment is trying to accomplish what we are saying is trying to accomplish, I think this adding investigate only confuses things, because we're talking about people who can prevent, suppress, or investigate our FPOs, and if we're not talking about them, then the amendment is adding investigate is pointless because it's not going to affect them anyways. They can already prevent or suppress, and we're also not talking necessarily about even fires. We're just talking about preventing the possibility of fires. And I think we're backdooring what we already dealt with in a previous amendment about going onto somebody's land, because now we're giving you the obligation to help them with preventing a future fire. Seems a little bit more than what we're talking about with the investigate part. Logically, it still doesn't follow that somebody who can only investigate, can't prevent or suppress, is going to require me to help them in preventing or suppressing when they're not authorized to prevent.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. That's your minute. Is the objection maintained?
Yes.
Please call the roll.
Representative Ledoux?
No.
Nay. Representative Crest Tompkins?
No.
Nay. Representative Eastman?
Yay.
Yay. Representative Reinbold is absent. Representative Kopp?
Nay.
Nay. Representative Stutz?
No.
Nay. Chair Klayman?
No.
Nay. One yay, five nays.
So by a vote of 1-5, amendment number 6 has failed. Amendment number 7, Representative Eastman.
I move amendment number 7.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Yes, in section 14 on page 4, we talk about backfires and burnouts, and we talk about basically an exemption that's going to make it so that backfires, burnouts, and other burning of land under the direct of an officer or employee of the United States or the state who is authorized to prevent or suppress fires. What we have neglected to include here is when you are the owner of a property and you are looking at your property contributing to the spread of a forest fire, because you do have that as a very real an exigent threat at the circumstance. We have authorized others to set a backfire, but we have not authorized in the statute someone who it's actually owns the land setting that backfire, both to prevent their property from being burned and then also, more important to the community, of preventing their property from being used to propagate a forest fire and then burning other property as well.
Thank you. Questions or comments about amendment number 7? Representative Ledoux.
I'm not sure what a backfire or a burnout is.
Sounds like a question for Mr. Mache. Mr. Mache?
Yes, thank you. Chris Mache again, Director of Division of Forestry, through the Chair, Representative Ledoux. Backfire or burnout are fires that our fire suppression crew members actually set to burn out unburned fuel between an advancing fire and a control line that we've constructed, or a natural feature such as a river or a road will burn out the fuel in front of the fire's approach to to lessen its impact when it hits our control line. And then it makes it easier for us to defend that control line, and it makes it safer actually for our firefighters in the process.
Thank you.
I have a question for, I think, Ann Nelson, who's the Assistant Attorney General on this. What is the impact of this proposed amendment on the immunity statute?
Mr. Chair, Ann's not able to be with us. I could speak to that if you'd like, or Aaron.
Either one's able, fine with me. Just curious.
I can take a first crack at it, and then Aaron can join in. The current statute, it just...
This is Chris Mache. State your name for the record, though.
You bet. This is Chris Mache, Director of Division of Forestry. And what this change does is it makes it clear that the discretionary immunity statute does pertain to backfires and burnouts. Burnout is a new term that's being added also in this piece of legislation. The way the current statute reads, it makes it starts out notwithstanding other provisions of law, and then that's where you find the section about discretionary immunity. So there could be some confusion in how it currently reads. We've actually successfully defended the current statute as it reads in a recent case just 2 years ago. Brewer and the Millers Reach Fire both spoke to this point, but this change makes it absolutely clear that it does pertain.
And, Mr. Peterson, do you want to add anything to what Mr. Mache just said?
Mr. Chairman, this is Aaron Peterson, Department of Law, Criminal Division. Now, Mr. Mache covered it. If that answered the question, then I would be content to rely upon his answer.
Does the administration oppose this amendment? Just Chris Mache, or is this Aaron Peterson?
This is Chris Mache, and the administration, DNR, does oppose the amendment.
Can you explain why?
Yes. The rationale for this is it would be very rare for a private individual to have the proper training and knowledge to actually safely set their own burnout or backfire. It can cause safety problems for our firefighters, not knowing that fire might be behind them if they're in front of the fire. It can also cause damage to private ownership, such as homes or businesses, which then would be an additional consequence for that individual that's not trained to do that type of control. And therefore, we oppose the amendment.
Any further questions or comments about Amendment Number 7? In wind-up, Representative Eastman, you have 1 minute.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes. So in this particular situation, we're only talking about private property rights and someone using their own private property to aid their community, perhaps themselves also in preventing their property from being used to spread a wildfire. And in that situation, I think we would be wrong to make someone criminally liable to prevent them from being able to act in their and our own best interests. And also we have recent news stories where this not being in statute was used against ranchers to their detriment, and I believe to ours as well. And I hope that that doesn't happen here in Alaska.
Thank you very much. The objection is maintained. Please call the roll.
Representative Cox?
Yes.
Representative Stutes?
No.
Yay. Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Crest Tompkins?
No.
Nay. Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Reinbold is absent. Chair Klayman?
No.
Nay. 3 yays, 3 nays.
So by a vote of 3-3, Amendment Number 7 has failed. That brings us to Amendment Number 8.
I move Amendment Number 8.
I'll object.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So moving right along, we're now on page 6, line 14. This is section 20, and we're making changes here, giving, I think, probably what most firefighters are hopeful will be the best part of this particular bill, at least certainly the most well-known, is we're adding the opportunities and so forth. What this amendment does is it makes clear that when you were talking about making an arrest, that that arrest is only for crimes that would be a misdemeanor or a felony, rather than the other, you know, potential category would be a citation. And I don't think we want our fire service officers to be known or to be threatening to other people or to have other people perceive them in any other way than they are. If they're issuing a citation, that's a citation. If they're going to be making an arrest for a misdemeanor or a felony, I think that's appropriate. But I don't think we want the public to be under the apprehension that they might be arrested for some type of violation that would only at worst be receiving a citation.
Questions or comments with regard to Amendment Number 8? Question for the department, whether that's either Mr. Mace or Mr. Peterson. Actually, we'll start with Mr. Peterson. Can you address whether this the issues that this particular amendment may raise?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So this is Aaron Peterson for the Department of Law, Criminal Division. It this amendment might raise some confusion because the text of the amendment says that person may be arrested only for a, it says insert punishable as misdemeanor or felony. And so many of the offenses in Title 41 would be punishable either as a strict liability violation, if this were to pass, if there were no mental state, and a misdemeanor, if there were a culpable mental state. So in a broad reading of it, it could be read to mean that a violation that could be punishable as a misdemeanor with a culpable mental state, if it were charged that way, could give rise to an arrest, which generally there is not going to be arrest. I mean, there isn't going to be arrest in a violation because there's no possibility of incarceration. So that's already the case, but I do think that it could muddy the waters and lead to some confusion, given the otherwise pretty clear-cut delineation between strict liability violation and misdemeanor based upon mental state.
So either Mr. Mace or Mr. Peterson, can you describe a situation in which a person might only be charged the violation might be a violation not a misdemeanor or a felony. Can you describe a setting in which a officer may need to arrest a person based on their violation or based on violating a violation? I guess I'm being redundant, but that doesn't carry any potential for jail time where they would still nevertheless believe there was a need to arrest someone. I'm not sure whether that's a question for Mr. Peters and Mr. Mace, but if one of you could explain that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is Aaron Peterson. No, I can't. I mean, they wouldn't be arresting on a violation. So I couldn't think of a situation where that would happen.
Anything to add, Mr. Mace?
No, this is Chris Mace, Director of the Division of Forestry. I would concur with Aaron's statement, Mr. Peterson's statement.
Okay. So, Representative Ledoux.
I thought by the very nature of a citation, you can't arrest somebody. I mean, I thought that was kind of the difference between a citation and a misdemeanor or a felony.
I think they've pretty much confirmed that. All right, I don't see any other questions. Representative Price Tompkins, is the objection main? Representative Cobb, did you have a question?
I was wanting to hear clearly from the Department of Law if they think this amendment makes it more or less confusing for enforcement. I wasn't clear.
Mr. Peterson, does the amendment make it more or less confusing for law enforcement?
Mr. Chairman, it makes it more confusing, in my opinion, because could give rise to someone thinking, well, this could be punishable as a misdemeanor, I'm charging it as a violation, which I can't arrest for, but it could be punishable as a misdemeanor, so I can arrest. I think that would create confusion that wouldn't otherwise exist.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I don't see any other questions or comments, and wind up, Representative Eastman, you've got a minute.
Yes, so now, if there were another provision of law, the one we're just referring to now, where it says a person may arrest a person who violates a provision, then I think we'd be talking apples to apples. But that's not what we're talking about in those other situations. What we're talking about here is we now have the ability to arrest a person who violates a provision of this chapter, and that's not confusing. If you violate a provision of this chapter, any provision, the slightest, strict liability or otherwise, then we have now given the authority that they may be arrested. And I think that that is, if we're not intending to do that, then we should change it. If we're not intending to do that, then we shouldn't be letting the public have the apprehension that they could be arrested for violating a provision of this chapter. I think we need to make it clear in some way that's what this amendment is intended to do.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Is the objection maintained?
Yes.
Please call the roll.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Reinbold is absent. Representative Cox?
Nay.
Nay. Representative Stutz?
No.
Nay. Representative Ledoux?
No.
Nay. Representative Perez Tompkins?
No.
Nay. Chair Klayman?
No.
One yay, five nays.
So by a vote of 1-5, Amendment Number 8 has failed. With regard to Amendment Number 9, Amendment Number 9 rolls Amendments 2 through 8 into a single amendment, and because we've already considered all the issues in Amendments 2 through 9 and all those amendments have failed, I'm ruling Amendment Number 9 out of order. That brings us next to Amendment Number 10.
Yes, I move Amendment Number 10.
I will object.
Representative Eastman.
Yeah, so this amendment deals with a current failure in our statute. And in our statute, we have so thoroughly redefined our terms that they make sense only to the attorneys or those who are particularly well-versed in the law, and very little sense to the public because of our definition of forested land. And I think when any member of the public sees the word forested followed by land, they have a very general, probably consistent understanding of what that means. And I would hazard a guess as to say that probably involves, at a minimum, some type of trees, for example, large bushes. Anyways, timber. And that is not the definition that we are using for this bill. In fact, the definition of forested land that we're using in this bill has really nothing to do with trees, though they would fall under it because almost anything would fall under it. In fact, as has been pointed out previously, if you know, even if you're talking about water and land underwater and you're talking about a tide going out and you're talking about a kelp paddy, that under our current definition of forested land would qualify. So if we want kelp to be considered a forest, then I think this amendment probably is not good. But if we want to deal with what I think the intent of the use of forested land is through in this this bill, which is referenced many times, then I think we're talking about not just any land or any vegetation or kelp. I think what we're talking about is flammable material. And that, and this is why this language is made more specific. Rather than talking about forested land as defined, we're talking specifically about land that actually has material that can burn on it. And I think that would make clear what we're trying to do, and it would also bring the public along with us in what we're trying to do.
Thank you, Representative Christ-Hopkins. Question or comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking up a definition. I think I understand the intent of the maker of the motion. I guess my first question would be, are there instances in which it would seem overly broad definition of forested land, which has been problematic to your knowledge?
Representative Eastman?
Yeah, so the question is not only what is under the current statute and how that's interpreted, but also what we're doing it through this bill. And through this bill, of course, we're expanding on many fronts what the fire service individuals can do and should do, which is fine. But I think that's all being done in the context. I mean, when you're talking about someone who's in the fire service, they're thinking about things from a fire perspective. And the public isn't necessarily thinking that way. And so when the public is thinking about land, and they would contrast that with forested land, then there's quite a contrast there. Whereas fire service individuals are thinking more about what can burn and how quickly and you know, what's the fuel load on a particular land, all those kinds of things. So I'm not aware of what would normally be considered, you know, forested land being abused or misused right now. What I'm keying in on is the fact that we're now taking this old kind of very tailor-fit definition of forested land. Now we're applying it in this much more expansive way, and so it's going to cause potentially new issues going forward with enforcement and public education. Just what is the public going to understand? And I wanted to make it clear, you know, what we're talking about here.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Price, comes.
Now or later, I was going to ask.
Go ahead, and then I've got Representative Kopp in the queue when you're finished.
I guess a question for Mr. Mache, what his thoughts on the proposed definition are.
Mr. Mache?
Yes, I wasn't sure if I was unmuted, but I guess I still am. So, yes, this is Chris Mache, Director of the Division, through the Chair, Representative Tompkins. Forest land is defined, of course, in the statute right now. It's 4115.170, which is the definition section, item 3. And this definition includes all land on which grass, brush, timber, i.e. is trees, and other natural vegetative material grows. And it's that last part that is key, because it's very difficult for us to predict what type of vegetative material might actually be flammable and carry a fire. I would note that inflammable is a confusing term to the layperson. In fact, the NFPA, which is the National Fire Protection Association, stopped using that term in the 1920s and instead uses the term flammable, as opposed to inflammable. And so we would oppose this definition change.
Further follow-up, Representative Price?
Well, just as a comment, that it's not really here nor there. Well, maybe it is here nor there with the amendment, but the use of inflammable caught me off guard because I had to look it up. normally, if you see IN before a word, that allophone usually refers to a negative, but apparently not here. But I can see how it would create confusion. Confuse me.
Representative Kopp.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just noted that. So AS 41 is public resources, and Chapter 15 is titled Forests. This is all about managing forests and contracting for the care of this resource. So I think the use of the term forested is consistent within the statute, and I think that for the person reviewing the law, it's internally consistent, because its very heading and intent has to deal with management of state forests on public land. So, and I just would note that I think we might be unintentionally changing language that could make it not consistent with what the law was written for in the first place. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Kopp. And I don't see any other questions or comments. I'll just note that, although I'm somewhat also curious about the use of the apparently 1920s term of inflammable material, but it strikes me that if one had a gas can sitting on in a vacant lot, that would probably fits the definition of inflammable material. But looking at forested land, which has some requirement of vegetative growing and material, it would be very different than fighting forest fires. And so I have trouble with the amendment. Representative Eastman, I see no other questions or comments. You've got a minute in windup.
Thank you. Well, as you just noticed, there is this requirement of natural vegetation here, and I think that also takes away from what we're trying to do. Someone has stacked up all sorts of flammable material that is not naturally vegetative, lots of gas cans or whatnot, then certainly this doesn't fall into the definition of forested land. But land that's not flammable and has no risk of being flammable in the near future, we're calling that forested land. And I think that's what the request is designed to get away from. It's the public understanding that if there's really no chance of it burning, then we probably shouldn't be calling it forested land if it has no trees and isn't going to have any in the near future.
Thank you very much. Is the objection maintained?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Please call the roll.
Representative Christ Tompkins?
No.
Nay. Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Nay. Representative Reingold is absent. Representative Kopp?
Nay.
Nay. Representative Stoops?
No.
Nay. Representative Ledoux?
No.
Nay. Chair Kleinman?
No.
Nay. One yay, five nays.
So by a vote of 1-5, Amendment number 10 has failed. That is the last of the amendments that we have. That brings the bill, House Bill 355, back before the committee. Is there any further discussion? And I'll give each member one opportunity with a time limit of 3 minutes per member. Anyone wanting to comment on House Bill 355?
Chairman.
Representative Kopp.
Yes, I will just note in our packet we had a letter of support from the Camp and Silla Borough Office of the Mayor. As we know, they have had a significant rash of wildfires, and their borough is strongly supporting this. I think we've discussed some good policy calls. I think perhaps in the next committee, as this bill goes through, we can further fine-tune the definition of who a person has a duty to disclose to if they are carrying a firearm. I think if we are able to work in the term sworn law enforcement, that'll make it explicitly clear that those deputy fire marshals are fire marshals who are sworn peace officers under the law, that and they are uniformed and badged, that there is a duty. But our committee doesn't have to address every issue, but I think it was a good one what we highlighted, and I know this will continue to have some good work done to it as it goes forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no other questions or comments, I have a motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move version 30-LS1382/J as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes from committee.
Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing none, House Bill 355 moves from committee. We will adjourn our meeting. Please be sure you stay afterwards or sign the paperwork as I'm talking. Our next meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, April 4th at 1 p.m. As I announced earlier, on Wednesday we will hear House Bill 387, AG Schedule Controlled Substances, sponsored by my office, and House Bill 367, Native Corporation Liability for Contamination, sponsored by Representative Millett. If anyone is considering offering an amendment to House Bill 387 or House Bill 367, please let my office know and be sure to submit them electronically by 4 p.m. on Tuesday, which is tomorrow. And with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is 8:04 p.m. Please stay afterwards to sign the paperwork.